This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 3rd of June 2014 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Grundig. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. Coming up today, we delve deep into 100 years of typeface design at a new exhibition in New York.
1,058 different full stops, each one unique. They cover the floor and they go from the floor all the way up to the ceiling. You walk in there and immediately you're hit by really the DNA of typography.
We think about the future at a Paris exhibition that collects together all the winners of the Global Award for Sustainable Architecture, which has been running since 2007.
We work together with 104 people. All those 104 people are owner of that building because they made it with their own hands. So I'm not an architect who says, this is my building. No, no, this is not my building. It is their building.
And then we climb aboard a time machine to profile the work of master clockmaker Daniel Veal.
It became very obvious that for Daniel, time itself was a central focus, that he thought, how do I slow it down? How do I make it visible?
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Let's begin the show in New York to pay tribute to that most ubiquitous of design forms, typeface. A new exhibition in the city, curated in part by Monotype, a leading provider of font and type technology, and global design firm Pentagram, sets out to tell the story of type, from its history to the balancing of its influence on communication. As the title suggests, Century, 100 Years of Type and Design, explores these themes in an extensive exhibition at the AIGA National Design Center in New York City. There's even a room decked out with thousands upon thousands of full stop signs. That's periods to our friends in the US, all of them different. In a moment, Allard John will discuss the relevancy of the exhibition with its curator and Monotype's creative director, James Fuchs Bale. But first, our New York bureau chief, Marcus Hippie, takes the tour of the exhibition with Monotype's studio type director, Dan Rattigan.
We're in the exhibition space now, and the walls and ceilings have been dotted with hundreds of typographic periods, and actually some of those can be seen also as an animation that's on one of the walls. Do we actually see all of them over there? Or?
Not on the animation. The walls feature over 1,000 periods, the periods from over 1,000 typefaces. There's a good selection of them in the animations running. I think about 600 made it into the animations.
And just to give an overview of what's going on here at the exhibition, what do we see in front of us, for example, over here at the moment?
The collection we have here is a selection of promotional material made by the Strathmore Paper Company, ranging from 1897 up until about 1970.
And what do you like about these the most?
Well, the thing that's so surprising to me about all the Strathmore items is that they're so well preserved. And particularly, we see color that we don't associate with a lot of these different periods, especially the 20s and 30s that have some really vivid pieces here. So it's sort of beautiful, inviting design, but the objects are so pristine that they're a real surprise to see them.
What do you mean about the colors?
Well, like say this set that we have here, these really, really vivid color palettes that they're showing off in the paper and the kind of printing on the paper have not often survived on other kinds of ephemera that we see from the 1930s. We're used to seeing a much more muted palette from those years just because of how the materials have faded over time.
That's really interesting. So you're basically saying that we've kind of got the 1920s and 1930s slightly wrong.
Yeah, I think people tend to see them through the filter of black and white movies and faded bits of paper and posters that we see once in a while. And it's so exciting to see stuff that was just put into an envelope right at the start and unearthed only recently.
And Dan, I promise that you can actually introduce us some of your favorite things from your exhibition. So shall we move pretty much to the other end of this exhibition space?
One of the objects that I really love is this specimen book from the Haas Type Foundry for Neue Haas Grotesque, their typeface that would go on to become much more famous when it was called Helvetica. But what I love about this is that it's not just showing what the type family looked like, but that the pages are meant to be swatches, like a Pantone swatch book or paint chips. There are these different combinations of type size and leading that a designer could tear out from the book and paste down in the layout. Traditionally, before the era of digital fonts and desktop publishing, designers would always get their type from a third party, so they need to be able to visualize what it is they were going to specify, what they were asking for. Something like this swatch book really lets them paste something down so they could see and not just imagine what a specific typeface is going to produce at a certain spec.
Something that caught my eye when I entered this exhibition space is five relatively big pictures, drawings on the wall. What is the story of these?
Well, we wanted to commission some new work to show that new things going on in typography are not just software and digital stuff. So we commissioned British printmaker and designer Alan Kitching to do a series of prints based on five of his design heroes who were all born in 1914. Alan does beautiful press compositions with this vast library of wood type that he purchased some years back. So here he's done tributes to Thomas Eckersley, Abram Gaimes, F.H.K. Enrion, Joseph Mueller Brockman, and Paul Rand. And then, so these are limited edition screen prints based on his experimental press compositions, trying to capture the spirit and the color palettes of these five heroes of his.
Well, after these new works, should we go and see one of the oldest things we can see over here at the exhibition space, which also is one of your favorites?
Yes, indeed. So one of the oldest things that we have here is a book that was printed by John Baskerville in 1772. Baskerville's types are famous because they've been popular for so long now. But at the time, they were actually meant to show how good a printer he was. A lot of Baskerville's revolution was that he printed extremely well on extremely high quality paper with high quality inks. So he actually cut types to show off what a good printer he was, types that other printers of the day would have had trouble working with as well. So there's this kind of unity of all the elements coming together for this stuff. But this particular battered copy of the Comedies of Terence, we found in the archives at Monotype, and we know that this copy was actually used for Monotype's version of Baskerville that was released in 1920. And it was that Monotype Baskerville that was carried over through the years and was digitized in 1992 and exists as the digital Monotype Baskerville that we have today. So there's this kind of chain of right here of the typographic development going on over the course of a couple hundred years.
Dan Rattigan of Monotype giving Marcus Hippie a tour of the exhibition. And here's its curator, James Fuchs Bale, with Section D's Aled John.
Type is an often celebrated thing, I think. Let's go about how you managed to make the exhibition different to a lot of the narrative that celebrates, quite rightly, type's role in design.
In general, typography is having a bit of a resurgence right now. It touches so many people in so many different ways. So the idea of the exhibition for us really was to put on a spread of many different libraries, many different access points into typography, and to make it accessible to the wider community, not just designers, but communication in general.
How do you go about doing that then? It's not just a gallery full of pictures of letters.
No, it's not. We went out to a number of different people, other organisations, to pull upon their archives, really. So this isn't just a story about Monotype. This is a story about Condé Nast and their archive. It's a story about Mohawk Paper and their archive. It's a story about the AIGA and what they have. And generally looking at the past 100 years, how those different archives, alongside about 6 or 7 other organisations, how they all channel together to tell some sort of story over the past 100 years.
Yeah, so it's a hell of an undertaking to take on that, not just the timescale, but also the collection of designers that you guys, Monotype and Pentagram, have worked with in this exhibition. Give a little bit of background about Monotype and what your work is first.
So Monotype's been around for over 100 years now, with perhaps the longest standing library or foundry that's still running today. So really, it was a way of working with those other collaborators, if you like, or the curators from those other libraries to thread together something which had some impact, not just in terms of what type is on display, but how that type has been used in many, many different ways.
Type is quite an interesting thing where the sort of ubiquity of it and the commonplace nature of it, in some senses, might lead people to sort of sidestep it and not pay much attention to it at all. So how do you put together an exhibition which draws attention correctly to the importance of type?
Like you say, there's so many access points into typography, whether you're just a reader and you're just immersing that copy without even realizing what typeface it is, whether you're a designer and you're actively selecting a typeface. There's so many different approaches to type, and it was a way of not really just celebrating one of those avenues, but as many as possible. So not really closing it down too soon. There's many design themes in there. There's many themes in terms of history and how that's played a role in communication. There's design trends in there from some of the partners and communication developments as well that have taken a place along the way. So there's a whole host of different ways you could enjoy that exhibition.
Can we, if we could for a moment, look at some of the examples of type that feature in the exhibition and some of perhaps your most favourite or preferred examples from the last 100 years?
I think for me, the most interesting application of type in that room is actually what Abbott Miller has brought to the space. It's a truly immersive. The downstairs area is between 3,000 and 4,000 square feet. It's been completely decaled in, I think it's 1,058 different full stops, each one unique. They cover the floor and they go from the floor all the way up to the ceiling, and it's a double height space. So you walk in there and immediately you're hit by really the DNA of typography, taking a constant such as a full stop and looking at how it differs through so many different typefaces, I think allows anyone really walking into that room how diverse typography can be and how much of a role it can play. Such a simple thing, a full stop, but to see it in so many different disguises or guises really elevates the whole space.
Let's look at the animations as well. There's two animations that feature in the gallery. You've got Fractured Century and Full Stop. I'm guessing Full Stop is the animation regarding Abbott Miller's work.
Yeah, they're both generative, so you shouldn't see the same thing happen twice. Abbott really wanted to add to the space and draw upon the identity. He may be better placed to answer this question than me, but essentially you've got the century of typefaces going through what is essentially a clock animation. So every single segment of that clock or hour on that clock becomes a new element of that C, drawing upon a different typeface every single rotation, every single segment. The other is a continuation of the full stops on the walls. So it's a period, a pulse, if you like, pulsing through the library of typefaces. I think there's over 200 different circulations that go through that animation. But every time it goes through the animation, you never see the same typeface twice. So they're all captioned as well. So you get that diversity and you get to know, if you so wish, what every single one of those typefaces are named.
You can find out if you
can find out. Yeah. There's a legend on the wall as well, which gives you background into which typefaces were picked for that decal.
Just finally then, James, what was it like for you as a man who comes from an organisation with great pedigree in this area to embrace a project which sort of celebrates the work that not just you do, but the work that you focus on?
It's an absolute privilege, really, to work with such talented people and with such vast archives of real depth and flavour, many of which haven't been on display before. So to be able to handle those pieces and to edit those pieces and to select those pieces was a massive privilege, but also a huge challenge, what to select and what not to select, trying to edit it down into that space.
It's a funny thing, isn't it? Because you can see a letter and it recalls memories from a newspaper you read back in the day, or the spacing of the lettering between two words. Yeah, and that, I guess that's the joy of looking at something like that, recalls to you moments of time.
Exactly that, yeah.
Monotype's creative director, James Fuchs-Bale, co-curator of the current AIGA exhibition, Century, 100 Years of Type and Design, speaking to Aled John. We'll be back after this short break to explore a recent exhibition which attempts to, in its own words, re-enchant the world through architecture.
For over six decades, Grundig has made people's lives better and simpler. To this day, we bring our expert knowledge of design and technology to a wide range of high-quality domestic appliances. Whether refrigerator or radio, oven or audio system, we continue to integrate our manufacturing heritage with state-of-the-art technology. Grundig synthesizes the best of yesterday with the best of tomorrow, expertly and innovatively designed for you and your home. Grundig, supreme engineering, timeless design.
You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. I'm Tom Morris. Can architects and designers be the leaders in the search for solutions to the looming challenges of climate and population? A group of European architectural academics think so. In 2007, they began bestowing annual awards on architects who they felt were finding creative solutions to the big global problems. Each year, five designers, urban planners and architects have been summoned to Paris to receive a global award for sustainable architecture. Their work ranges from major urban developments like Rotterdam Central Station to small village projects in far corners of the world. This year, the 40 award winners to date are part of an exhibition, Réenchanter le Monde. It opened last week at the Cité de l'Architecture in Paris, and Annie Hastwell was there for Section D.
An eclectic crowd of architects and designers from all over the world are gathered in the shadow of the Eiffel Tower for the opening of this exhibition. It's called Reenchant the World, and they've all been chosen for their creative solutions to the ecological and social problems the world faces. Marie-Hélène Contal is deputy director of the Cité de l'Architecture in Paris and the curator. She explained why the awards were set up in the first place.
The idea at the beginning was to help architects engage in their own country in this challenge with a big transition, and sometimes they were very lonely, because when you are 3 steps ahead, you return and you see there's nobody behind you and with you. They were very, very lonely, and it was time to maybe to find them and to try to build something like an architecture stage, a stage able to be more visible on this wall. Because the stage of postmodernist architecture is pretty strong, pretty visible, pretty powerful, and pretty wrong.
It's the organic cafe versus McDonald's. That's the difference between the sustainable architecture projects in this exhibition and the massive corporate building boom transforming cities worldwide. Dutch architect Arne Veenstra is definitely in the organic cafe category. He received an award in 2012 for his work on community projects in Afghanistan.
I believe in slow architecture. So the same with food. You had a moment in time when people were eating fast food, and now people are leaning towards slow food. And I believe architecture takes time to make it. One of the advantages that architecture is a slow profession is that you also have time to engage with the people who actually built it. So one thing that I learned in Delft, where I graduated as a master's, is how to design something. But it's very, very important that you also build it. So we do a lot of projects without a contractor, but we work directly with the carpenters and the masons and the skilled people who actually make it. And that creates an ownership. So if the people, the local people, for instance, a small building in Afghanistan, it's called the house with the dancing windows, it's not even 100 square meters, but we work together with 104 people. All those 104 people are owner of that building because they made it with their own hands. So I'm not an architect who says, this is my building. No, this is not my building. It is their building. It belongs to them.
Young German architect Anna Heringer has come to Paris from China, where she's currently working with locals, building a rather unusual youth hostel.
The inner core is out of stone and rammed earth. And then outside there's a shell, like a huge basket out of bamboo weaving, and which has a lot of craftsmanship involved. And Chinese craftsmen are really fantastic in doing these things. And then attached on this mud structure, there are like these Chinese lampions, like sleeping concourse. It's a youth hostel, so the boys and girls are staying in, like it's a vertical camp. So it's very basic, but also quite archaic and hopefully poetic. And it has a microclimate inside of the bamboo basket with a lot of plants there. And it's a very simple way of building sustainable and not so much focused on all these high-tech solutions where you have a lot of grey energy also embodied. And I believe we have to learn building simple again.
How can small, simple projects in remote parts of the world, though, really have an effect on the incredible building industry, which is being driven too by, you know, population growth?
I think it's possible to, because the population growth means a lot of labor force also, and also a danger if we don't use it, because that's a huge potential for aggression if we have a lot of unemployed youth. And I think there's no way to not to do it and not to work with the people. And I think we really have to focus on buildings that are based on craftsmanship to really have the capacity and potential to involve a lot of people.
I'm Karen Smuts. I come from South Africa and I work predominantly in the Western Cape.
What kind of projects do you do?
We do a lot of developmental work. We like working in contexts where people are disadvantaged, so some townships, some rural settlements, and we try and focus on public architecture.
Karen Smuts admits there are challenges in working with locals rather than just designing for them.
Sometimes older people will always come and say they want a traditional building, they want a round grass-roofed hut, and you're actually in a contemporary city and you need to produce contemporary architecture. So often it takes time to get them around to understanding that from a hut you can move to a cone or to another shape that is representational of the hut, but it's a contemporary shape.
It does seem a long way from the African township to the problems facing rapidly growing cities in Europe and Asia. But Karen Smuts believes the same design principles of adapting from what exists and consulting the community can be translated to bigger cities and to bigger building contexts.
I think that too often planners and architects work in isolation, they work alone, they don't communicate. But I was very fortunate to go to Gothenburg in Sweden, where the city works with the public and with the people to try and find solutions for things. And I think that it's a start. You know, I think that people need to put solutions in the public domain and not keep it, you know, with the professionals. I think what we do at the small scale, the minute you do it at a big scale, it could have an impact on the city.
So it's about asking people what they want.
Yes, it's about asking people what they want.
Reenchant the World is an impressive and deeply idealistic exhibition. Marie-Hélène Contal hopes it can prompt a change in how architects see their role in society.
An architect is not an artist able to make a testimony and not engage the society, just present in the world to make a beautiful object. I ever thought that an architect is an actor of development, of his country, of his society. Of course he's an artist, but at the end of the processus, because he gives a face, and a beautiful face to the development, but it is because he's engaged in it, because he has to deal with the industry of construction. He has to deal with society. He has to deal now with resource. He has to deal with energy. So I hate this vision of the architect as an angel on a cloud, an artist, a painter painting in three dimensions. No, he ever was an actor of development. And this is stronger now. But why is it stronger now? It is because all the parameters of development are in the phases of huge change.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Annie Hastwell.
Thanks, Annie. Coming up, we'll review some of the designs on offer at this year's Clerkenwell Design Week, forecast the stories on the agenda in Canada, and take a trip through time with a report from London's Design Museum. This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. Now in London these last few weeks, we've seen the rather compact Clerkenwell Design Week showcase its own offerings. And as Alla John reports, Central London's Design District had much to offer.
In the design calendar, Clerkenwell Design Week sits in between the much larger and more subscribed events of Salone del Mobile and London Design Festival. It's an opportunity for journalists, design geeks and of course buyers alike to take a breather from Milan and get a glimpse of the products that may well grace the exhibition spaces of LDF come September. I'm here in the Design District in central London to hear from some of the designers with an interesting tale to tell. First, I'm off to meet South African designer Christopher Jenner, who has recently taken up the post of creative director for Eurostar and is here in Clerkenwell to showcase his collaboration with bathroom interior designers Drummonds.
This is my first collaboration collection of bathroom furniture, which is a huge privilege to be given the opportunity to create a collection of freestanding furniture for the bathroom. Essentially, what we're looking at is forms that are about structures and how structure defines form. So that's really the aesthetic starting point from the design perspective. But then also looking at how we can challenge tradition and craft.
You say structure, do you mean function? Or do you mean structure through function defines the form overall?
Exactly. I think in this case, it's about skeletal structure, which defines paneling and detailing within that structure. In the case of these, it's the outer extremities of the pieces, which are solid wood, which hold then the enameling pieces and the insert panels, which go into kind of left, right, center, front and back of the pieces.
Can I have a look inside?
Yeah, of course.
So this is a bathroom basin on top of a cabinet.
Yeah, a single vanity with a solid cast iron top that's been enameled with white. Oh, very challenging because you've got a vertical and a horizontal form. And to enamel complex curves is pretty much an impossible task. So it took quite a few reiterations to get the enameling process in line with the expectations from a quality point of view. All very simply constructed of solid wood. Again, on the fronts, we've got the cast iron process, which is very much a symbol of Drummonds as a brand. So it's really using the existing craft qualities of the brand, but bringing new language to them through the use of carpentry and wood.
Is it fair to say that there's a mixture of tradition and innovation here? Or are you trying to keep it quite old school in a sort of Drummond style way?
I think it's essentially respect for a brand is really important. Previously, they've made baths, towel rails, those items which are kind of predictable bathroom items. But as a brand grows, it's about looking for a new repertoire. So what we've done is taken that country house aesthetic and contemporized it, brought it into the city. So there's a certain element of the tradition of Drummond's through the manufacturing process and lots of shapes and forms, but making them essentially contemporary is key to this, making them relevant.
So this over here, the two bathroom basins, kind of screams that idea of contemporary and traditional to me, because the cupboarding underneath, especially the handles on the cupboards, they don't conflict, but they complement the taps on top with the basins, and the ceramic of the basin themselves seems to be at odds with the white of the cupboarding below. It's a nice sort of juxtaposition across
Absolutely.
The lot.
So again, looking at how do we challenge Drummond's as a brand so that they're constantly reinventing themselves and building their repertoire out is essential. Looking at building identity, whether it's on behalf of a brand or whether it's a cultural facet that you're trying to bring into the project, identity and craftsmanship, I think, are the two key defining kind of beacons.
So for you.
Yeah.
So looking at your role as creative director, is that a permanent role for Eurostar, or is that a project-based thing?
It's a permanent role, but it's project-based. Okay. So we've just launching a new ticket hall in St Pancras Station. And that was really interesting because you've got this brand which straddles two cultures. And you think strategically, how do you define a brand that belongs half in England and half in France and
that,
slightly in Belgium?
That, for me, is the most interesting side of it, because the name evokes Europe.
Yeah.
And as much as Britain is part of Europe, it's the name doesn't make you think of London, it makes you think of Paris. For me at least,
Absolutely.
And I grew up in London.
Yeah.
And there's definitely a European, a more continental feel, I guess, not European, to the style of the train and the experience of the journey.
Yeah.
But I guess it has to evoke London as well, and it has to evoke the UK, because it's a connection between the two places.
Yeah.
How do you manage to straddle that?
Because we obviously come from a very strategic point of view when it's working with a brand like that. And it was essential that the discourse was not between French and English culture, otherwise that would be an endless process that we've been trying to kind of sort out for thousands of years. For us, it was more about values within design and how those values could define a brand. So we looked at specifically Art Nouveau as a representation of French and Belgian culture. So values like organic fluidity and how organic and fluidity could define the customer process. And then as an obvious default, we went for Victorian Gothic for British culture. So things about symbolism and enrichment were really important. And by using values as opposed to kind of specific cultural indicators, there was the opportunity to define both of them in a single space. So those values actually dictate how it's designed.
Is that an easy marriage? We talk a lot about collaborations, but if you're trying to... There's a lot of composite parts there in terms of sort of aesthetic and design and cultural feeling behind objects. Are you finding that easy to do, mixing the Victorian with the innovative, for example?
Absolutely. I love all of that stuff, you know, all of those kind of cultural identifiers as part of a considered process in design is really enriching for one as a designer, because you're learning so much about materials and structure and form through these kind of value indicators. Yeah, love that process.
Christopher Jenner there. And over the road to the northerly side of St John Smith Square, and there's one brand that caught my eye while in Salone di Mobile. Se is a small but high-end brand that attempts to, in its own words, marry some of the world's best designers with the best manufacturers to create what the founder and creative director, Pavlos Dachlev, calls a radical kind of luxury. Pavlo is here to talk shop and sell his products, and at the moment is showcasing the work of Nika Zupank. Pavlo, thank you very much indeed. Tell me about the story of Se.
So I came up with a concept of doing a brand that would launch one collection with one designer at a time, as opposed to multiple different designers.
Is that a product of the fact you're still a fairly young company, or is that something that will change when you grow?
No, I think that's something that we want to keep. It's kind of very much at the core of the company. It allows every time that we work with a new designer, we launch a new collection, we have a sort of completely new creative kind of direction within the ethos and the brand itself. So it allows a continuous kind of evolution. It brings in different energy every time. So here we have, for example, Collection 3 by Nika Zupank, and we commissioned Nika to do 15 pieces, Most collections are between 15 to 20 pieces. And really the heart of it is, A, we kind of give the designer a brief, and in this case it was kind of 1950s kind of social environments. But you have to work with the materials that we really like working with. So here you have a combination of ceramic, different metals, marble, beautiful colours that we have as well, and a kind of an idea of the shapes and forms that we have, which is try to keep things a little bit feminine. So we tend to veer away from very sharp corners, L-shaped sofas, which are great, but there's a lot of it on the market. And that was really the drive behind the business, and hence why the name C is also a little bit kind of feminine, I guess. There's something a little bit kind of haute couture about it.
I'm really taken by this mirror here on the table.
Yeah, the mirror is really quite a revelation. Because
I don't even know how to describe it.
Well, it's not just a mirror, it's a whole experience. If you sit in front of it, you have a very strange perception of the world behind you that you can see from all different angles. It's very big, the mirror, first of all.
We're going to have to sit on this.
No, I think, I think you should
You
should
going to sit there with me?
Oh, I'll sit down with you, but you can. But what we noticed when we first sat there was how big you see everything, and the fact that you see behind you, you see on the side. So for a woman who's getting ready, because it was principally designed for women, you know, a dressing table. It's not sexist, it's just something that we wanted to do.
I mean, I don't have a dressing table myself.
I don't either. And that's one of the reasons why we did this, is because we felt that, you know, it'd be nice to create something really feminine, but using masculine materials like the iron, because there aren't that many really interesting dressing tables. And something that has such a strange kind of visual impact was a real treat for us. We didn't imagine it would have that until we physically tried it the first time when we saw the prototype.
I really am struck by it. It's quite captivating in a funny way. It's not an experience that I can relate to. Obviously, I don't have a dressing table anyway, but the sort of the mirror experience of going to the bathroom, I don't even know where to look. There's so many different angles of my face.
I think we had maybe 200, 300 people doing selfies when we showed it in Milan, and they'd put themselves in all different areas of the room. It's because it allows for such a really cool visual. So in the end, what we're going to do with this mirror now is develop it into a much bigger piece on its own, just a mirror on its own, very big for interesting hallways.
And just in terms of the description, it's three composite parts.
Yeah, it's a triptych mirror. The central part doesn't move. The two surrounding round mirrors kind of move backwards and forwards, like a butterfly in a way.
Yeah, it's quite something, and it is part of this table.
It is part of the table, but we're realising we've got two camps, people who like it as on its own and people who want it with the table.
So you said to Nika, I need two separate things.
So now we're developing a whole range of mirrors from this idea.
Just looking at the, not the business model per se, but the way, say, it's structured. So what is the cycle of a designer and their work? Does it depend on how successful the launch is, or do you have a kind of routine of one per year, one per season?
We had the idea of doing one per year, but it's not feasible. At all. Physically, it's impossible and it requires too much time. Now it's really one every 3 years, I think. Or when the feelings are right. Like with Nika, it just happened at the right time. We knew we had to do a third collection at some point. We didn't really have a fixed schedule or a fixed kind of strategy for it. We just knew that we had to find the right person to follow from collection two. Until we found that, we still had to reinvent some of our pieces to show to people that we're evolving as a company and we have different products. People want to see things that are new all the time. So you keep it going, and collections one and two are still very much there, and we will still keep selling them and showing them and, you know, presenting them in different ways, allowing people to discover them if they haven't seen them before. Some people will only know of Sina as a result of Nika. Some people will know Nika as a result of Sina, and vice versa for the other collections as well.
Pavlo Stachlev of Sina. Now, while luxury furniture, product and graphic design are ever present in the exhibitions here, the very contemporary issue of London's developing skyline is throwing up issues to be considered also. Dutch architect Professor Ben van Berkel is in town to give a talk on the issue of tall buildings and their development. In this case, why they should be imbued with residential characteristics. And as he tells Monocle's Alexandra May, it's all a question of belonging.
Your previous projects have been extremely innovative, and they've ranged from commercial projects to public ones to residential. And I was wondering what you find the main challenges of this type of design, which is high-end residential and catering to the top end of the market.
Well, you have to imagine that coming out of an English education, for me it's never been a problem to design and furniture towards maybe infrastructure, high-end housing and mixed-use projects. I've always liked to combine these different qualities, even sometimes in one project. Maybe with the earlier design for houses I did so in the early 90s, I discovered that it is interesting to think about the way how one is going to live in the future. Like the Möbius house, was already in the 90s about how two parts of a family would live and work at home. And I see that happening now more and more recently. In order to make living more lively, you need more amenities, you need more comfort around the way how one can work and live. And that's how I grew in the high-end market. I mean, we did so many high-end housing projects in Singapore. I'm not only applying it to these ideas to high-end housing alone. For instance, what we have learned is that even with affordable housing, if you don't mix more amenities towards it, if you don't make the location and the quality of the building more lively, then it will not sustain a social quality around the location of the affordable housing as what you can do also with high-end housing. So for me, I've always wanted to learn from the different scales of living and the different types of living, if it is affordable living, if it is high-end living. I wanted to give it always in different locations, different qualities.
In your projects, you're always trying to find an inward and an outward connection. So, you know, for the building to fit in with the traditions of the city and then also for the actual building itself.
Yeah, you know, I sometimes say there are internal regulations for architecture and external forces. And these external forces are related to the way how people use the infrastructure in a location, how they can combine different programs in the day. For instance, I did a study once related to a location in Manhattan around the Penn Station, where we discovered that the city department was not really aware of the amount of people leaving the site after 8 o'clock. And that's why people felt so unsafe in the area. When we showed them the numbers, I mean, we showed them in visualized in statistics, then they were highly excited to know that their knowledge was never visualized and never recognized in that way. So I, for that reason, I'd like to look at locations in a bottom-up manner, where people go, how do they move around, and what it is that could make a location a bit more lively also after 8 o'clock in the night.
My next question is around, you know, tall buildings, which are very much in fashion. Do you think that tall residential living is making a comeback?
Yeah, definitely. It's clearly around. And it is maybe because we have to deal with new forms of density. Of course, spreading was one of the qualities we dealt with in housing before, you know, that everyone could have a garden. But that is, of course, not everywhere possible anymore in the big cities. So high rises are not introduced only in London, as you know, but in many places of the world right now. But it is very important to introduce residential projects with the right amount of mixed programs around it. As I said before, the most important is that then a location becomes lively and safe comfortable for people to live in, and that they are not single programmed, like, you know, when you have only residential qualities in an area or only offices, then of course if people leave an office after 6 or 7 o'clock, then of course you would have an unsafe area and an unpleasant place to walk around in. So it's very important to correlate all the aspects of high-end residential projects in the relationship to also how they are linked together in an urban setting, etc.
Professor Ben van Berkel speaking to Monocle's Alexandra May, ending that report from Clerkenwell Design Week. This is Section D with me, Tom Morris, and we'll be back with a forecast of the design stories from a particular location around the world. This week, we're in Canada.
A careful balance between power and proportion is key to the success of Grundig's expert designs. The innovative Ovation Hi-Fi system radiates expansive sound from the most micro of machines. With its Magic Fidelity sound concept, the compact disc and iPod player is designed for the ultimate listening experience in your home, bringing big sound into small spaces. Grundig. Supreme engineering, timeless design.
It's time to look at the stories that should be on our radar from a particular location around the world. This week, our design forecast turns to Toronto. Monocle's Jason Lee sits down with Scott Weir, principal from Era Architects, to detail Canada's most pressing design developments.
So Scott, I know you want to talk to us about the Phyllis Lambert Prize, but before you do, can you tell us who Phyllis Lambert is and why is the prize significant?
Phyllis Lambert's a very important figure in my life in Canada, I would say, because she is an architect who was the founder of the Canadian Centre for Architecture. This prize is significant. It's within the UQAM University, but it's awarded to a student who has done work that is distinguished within the areas of urban design or architecture.
And they just announced the winner. So who won this year?
This year it's a fellow named Guillaume Etier from Montreal. He's a PhD student who's graduated from UQAM.
And what is so special about his thesis? Why did he win?
What's very interesting for us is that he was studying the period in Toronto that's being called the Cultural Renaissance between 2002, say, and 2010, looking at Toronto's intent to use public money to build a number of cultural institutions that could then reboot the economy of the city and the architectural impact of the city on an iconic level. And his thesis is very interesting because it evaluates these pieces. It evaluates the idea of iconography as being able to have done that, and then it puts a framework together to look at the individual designs that were done and whether they actually accomplished that job or not.
And this is like a massive rebranding effort on the part of Toronto, right?
Exactly.
Can you tell us some of the buildings that were built?
So the top four that he's really looking at, out of maybe a series of 10, there's the Four Seasons Centre for the Performing Arts by Diamond Schmidt. There's the Frank Gehry AGO rebuild. There's Liebskind's ROM edition. And then the fourth one that he's really considering is the OCAD building.
And what were some of his conclusions?
His conclusions really were that there's a framework of how one could go about building an icon within a city. I think Toronto has accomplished that to some extent. His questioning was really, so there's an idea that in order to be able to build an iconic building, it needs to be somewhat divorced from its surroundings, as well as the impact of the design of the building needs to be slightly divorced from its program. And then it has to have the ability to impact the architecture of the city that it's in and also kind of rebrand the identity of the people who live there.
So that was from 2002 to around 2010.
Yes.
Now moving forward to somewhere now in the present day, there's also another recent phenomenon that you want to draw attention to. What's it called?
So a second thing that I guess we've been looking at in the firm, I work for a firm called ERA Architects that does a lot of heritage work. And we tend to tag along with a number of other bigger projects to look at adaptive reuse of buildings. A phenomenon that's really been happening in Toronto and a number of other places lately, I would call facadism, where the facade of a building is retained, but a lot of the rest of the building is demolished as part of an adaptive reuse project. This, I think, is something that's resulting from a whole bunch of influences that are impacting the city that have to do with densification, the number of people who are moving downtown, mixed with goals of LEED and goals of green buildings, where you're trying to put people in close proximity to the places they're trying to go, and then mixed with problems with public transit, that we have a kind of underfunded system that doesn't serve all the neighborhoods of the city. So then you end up with this great overlay of our heritage old neighborhoods of the city mixed with a densification effort that hits the same buildings at the same time.
Can you give us an example?
There's a number of the condo buildings downtown. There's one at St. Joseph, which has a fantastic range of buildings on Yonge Street that are being retained in fully. And then there's a facade of one building that's being retained kind of behind the set of buildings along St. Joseph. The result is something that is, I think, an important part of city building, but there's a number of issues around it that need to be thought through on a policy level.
And ERA is working on the Casey House. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how that relates to facadism?
Yes. That, I guess, is sort of the counterpoint of adaptive reuse, where in the Casey House case, there's a large building on Jarvis Street that was in a semi-derelict state. Hariri Ponturini is doing a hospital addition to this building that has been able to incorporate a number of the spaces of the interior of the original building, along with this fantastic new modern piece that locks together with it.
So, Scott, tell me, does it just make more sense to demolish these buildings rather than to keep the facade and gut the interiors, for instance? Because when a person experiences a building, it's really the interiors that we're talking about.
I think it depends on how we're treating public space. And I think architects perhaps have not been thinking about the streetscape and how a normal person inhabits the street and what they take away as being important to them. In many cases now, people in Toronto are more concerned with the facades of the building and keeping that in place because they don't necessarily relate to the facades of new things going up. So you get this kind of fondness for these buildings, and that's what gets retained.
You work in Toronto.
Yep.
You work for a Toronto firm. But where are you from originally?
Yes, I'm from Windsor originally, which is across the river from Detroit.
And that's the last thing you want to talk about.
Yeah, the last thing I wanted to talk about was the Detroit Design Fest coming up in September. They're currently in a proposal call for Design Fest, looking at, they're hoping that Toronto and Montreal and Chicago would get involved in this as well as Detroit. Detroit's a really fascinating city for design.
Because no one really thinks Detroit and design at the same time, do they?
That could be. But when you think about the history of the city, the reason that the automobile industry came out of Detroit was because of the strength of design schools that were there. And those schools are still there. That design culture is still there. It's almost like it's gone through a disconnect, like a bit of a war in the last 50 years. That is now stabilizing within, I guess, the context of a bankruptcy. But culturally, the city is really coming back to itself. And the design stream in there is quite vibrant.
What are some of the interesting things we can look out for, you think?
There's a number of fantastic parties. There was one last year called Lighting Up Livernois, where an area of town that had been relatively abandoned was a number of art installations were put in as part of a rejuvenation process that's happening along that street. And now you can see a year later, new shops have been moving in and it's opening back up again.
And just very quickly, are there any ideas in the past design festivals that have actually been translated into reality?
Yes, actually, there have been. There's a company called Detroit Wallpaper Company that I think were in one of the previous renditions that is now producing some really beautiful work.
Scott Weir from Era Architects, running Jason Lee through the design stories on the Canadian calendar. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. And now, to end the show, let's head to London's Design Museum to go back to the future. Watchmaker Daniel Veal has designed iconic pieces for companies like Swatch and Krug. And his first show, dedicated entirely to his three-decade-long career, is now on at the Design Museum in London. Called Time Machines, the show examines Veal's personal journey from Argentina to the UK and the famous clockmaker's relationship with time. Monocle's Hayley Joel Ott has more.
At the Design Museum in London, Daniel Veal's clocks tick. He has designed three new ones especially for this retrospective show, which is about his three-decade-long career, but also connections and patterns made over a lifetime.
Instead of life going in a linear way, things recur.
That's curator Martina Margetz, who worked with Weil to tell his story in time and about it.
And things that really matter to one, one sort of goes back to certain ideas or certain memories or certain issues are central. And it became very obvious that for Daniel, time itself was a central focus, that he thought, how do I slow it down? How do I make it visible? He was born in Argentina in 1953, but his family had come over the last century. They'd come from Germany and from Italy as Jews escaping war, so they'd all settled in Argentina, but they were all from very distinguished and cultured family backgrounds, so they brought a sort of love of music and literature with them, but also a sort of knowledge of science. One of them knew Einstein and so on, so there was a sort of very strong interest in science and philosophy as well. And at the age of 14, he got a Saturday job in an ironmonger's, and that suddenly got him interested in all the componentry and the way things were made and the way they functioned. And he also then, at the age of 16, saw this enormous Bauhaus exhibition in Buenos Aires. So he really, with his background and his experiences then as a teenager, he thought, right, there is a big life out there in Western culture. And so I think he formed a wish to kind of reconnect with that, which of course was his family background.
From the beginning, Weil says he was preoccupied with time.
The big challenge for me was to bring the subject of time into design, as it had been the great transformer of the 20th century, from science with relativity and in art with cubism. No accident that relativity happened first, that science brought an intellectual debate of the break of the conventions of perception. And then cubism breaks the convention of the representation on the flat plane. And so I thought that time should have an impact in design. And I was, trying to add much more idea or a subject that was invisible to see if it could be pinned down. Now, 33 years of time is a good way of showing it, you know. So time machines were intended to be a good, catchy name, but it really it supports the idea that this is not just about today. It's about what I did in 81 to what I will do in the future and what we will all do in the future.
Weil says putting together a retrospective has taught him that he was never a blank slate.
Seriously, I think how relevant was my experience growing up and what I brought with me to this country, that somehow when I arrived I reinvented myself. This is I used another language, I started to dream in another language, I became self-taught in the matters of design, having been an architect, purely an architect before, and I started from scratch, I thought so, until I was putting this show together. As I thought in 1981, everything will connect one day, and things will carry on connecting. But they are not randomly done through algorithmic formulas. You don't come up with your own knowledge through the accidental finding and the information superhighway, but you need to develop a point of view and have moments of great passion and dedication to find out about it and then use it because it stays with you.
For Monocle in London, I'm Haley Joel Ott.
Thanks, Haley. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Today's show is produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer Aled at awj@monocle.com. I'm Tom Morris. And playing you out, here's Time by Tom Waits. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.
The smart money's on Harlem, and the moon is in the street, and the shadow boys are breaking all the laws. And you're east of East St. Louis, and the wind is making speeches, and the rain sounds like a round of applause. And Napoleon is weeping in the carnival saloon, his invisible fiance's in the mirror, and the band is going home. It's raining hammers, it's raining. It's true, there's nothing left for him down here. And it's time, time, time. And it's time, time, time. And it's time, time, time that you love. And it's time, time, time. And they all pretend they're orphans, and the memory's like a train. You can see it getting smaller as it pulls away. And the things you can't remember tell the things you can't forget. The history puts a saint in every dream. Well, she said she'd stick around until the bandages came off. But these mama's boys just don't know when to quit. Matilda asked the sailors, all those dreams or all those prayers. So close your eyes, son, and this won't hurt a bit. Oh, it's time, time, time. It's time, time.